Today's program was brought to you by Union Beer. For more information, visit greatbrewers.com.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Sharp and Hot. I am your host, Chef Emily Peterson, joining you live from Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This is episode number 102. We are coming into fall, and I'm so excited. It's my favorite time of year, but I had a hard time dressing myself for the temperature this morning. I'm underdressed, so I'm a little bit chilly. I also, as you can hear in my voice, I'm still getting over my cold that I had last week, which is why my delightful brother sat in for me. And I just want to say thank you to Joe. And if you didn't have a chance to listen, episode number 101, he was awesome. I was listening from afar, and I'm really, really proud of him. And I'm going to try to get him on a couple of times this winter when he's supposed to be writing, and I will distract him and he can be my sidekick. So thank you to everyone who tweeted me and messaged me to tell me how much you love my brother. I love him too. He is wonderful. Today's episode, I'm going to dedicate to talking about relationships in the kitchen. Last season, or maybe it was two seasons ago, I did a couple of different episodes where I interviewed couples about their stresses in the kitchen. And this has been a particularly stressful couple of months, I think, for couples. A lot of my friends are having some stress. I'm having some stress, not necessarily, oh my goodness, excuse me. Not necessarily in the romantic world exclusively, you know, like we have our relationship with food and our relationship with money and our relationship with time, which is one that I really myself struggle with, in that I don't use it wisely when I have it, and then I freak out when I haven't used it, and I'm trying to sleep in the middle of the night instead of count how many sausages I have for an event that I'm doing. Oh, speaking of which, thank you to everyone who came out to Oktoberfest this week, and I want to tell you that I think I missed my opportunity when I did the disaster show 2 weeks ago. I didn't really have... It's not that I didn't have a good disaster, but I earned my disaster story this week, you guys. I'm going to tell you really quick before we get to our guests. So I'm good at my job 99.9% of the time. And in every event that I've hosted or chefed and been paid to run and cook and be on and be me and all of the stuff that people who come to events want, 99.9% of the time it goes awesome. And in every event, there's a tipping point where I go from panicking, like, oh my God, I don't think I can do this. Why did I sign up for this? I can't believe I signed up for this. And I just want to like crawl into my bed and pull the pillows over my head because I feel like a phony and a fraud and they're going to figure out that I don't in fact know what I'm doing. But there's always this tipping point that comes in the planning process where I'm like, I got this. I got the food ordered. I know what I'm serving it on. I know who's going to help me. I know what I'm doing. And with a particular event this week, that never happened. That moment never came. And it was keeping me up at night. And if I was paying myself by the hour, I would have whittled my hourly wage down to 10 cents an hour based on the amount of time that I spent thinking about how I was going to pull this off. And on the day before the event, I broke my creme anglaise, which made me want to sit down on the floor and cry. It was just like the stress levels overflowed. And if you think about your stress as like a cup full of paper clips, eventually you could put in all the paper clips you want, and then it's just one paper clip is going to overflow the cup, right? So I wanted to cry about my creme anglaise. My friend who was working with me was like, we'll fix it tomorrow. Go home. Get some sleep. I was like, okay. Woke up in the morning, went back to the kitchen, fixed the creme anglaise, packed everything up. And I had this moment with a friend of mine who was working the event with me. I was like, I never hit the tipping point of feeling like I have this together. And she was like, you've got this together. We're going to go. It's going to be great. I get downstairs with about $1,500 worth of food on a warm sidewalk in downtown New York City. I run around the corner to go and get my car, and it's gone. My car's gone. And I'm going to say the F word here. So if you've got children in the car with you, turn it down for a second. Because all I could think was, I'm fucked. I'm totally fucked. I don't know what I'm going to do. And so I went back to where my friend was standing with all the food. And she's like, you're not in your car. I was like, no, my car got towed, I assume. And she's like, okay. And she could see I was like shaking and I'm I can't believe I didn't cry. I can't believe I didn't just like sit down on the curb and start bawling. She was like, Peterson, pull yourself together. Your car is safe. It's in the tow pound. We got to go. So I called an Uber, and halfway to Brooklyn, I realized I can't go because the pop-up kitchen setup that I'm supposed to be using is also in my car, and I don't have it. So I jumped out of my Uber, and I sent her with all of the food to the venue, and I was like, you just, whatever you do, make them think that I've got myself under control. And I hopped in a different taxi, learned that you cannot take two Ubers at once. Uber's app won't let you do that. So I had to take a yellow cab up to the tow pound, which by some merciful miracle was empty. I was in and out in 20 minutes, and I got my car. I did the event, and it was fine. It was totally fine. But as someone who usually has their selves together, and I pride myself on like solving all the problems before they happen, that was the biggest disaster I have ever experienced, ever. And so I wish I had a like punchline. It's like, no, the car got towed is the punchline, and then I made it work. But yeah, so my relationship with time and stress and all of those things, I think are worth talking about. And you guys all responded that when I had the couples in the kitchen segments in the past, you really liked them. So to that end, I'm going to bring my guests on with me who are joining me by phone from Texas, Cappy and Susie Lawton. Welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
I really appreciate
that's a harrowing story. I don't know whether to laugh or cry.
I know. So I did a show about disasters a couple of weeks ago. Do you guys have any good disaster stories to share?
Hadn't thought about that. I might have to think about that for a minute. I'm sure I do. I have many of them. I've been in the restaurant business for a long time. It's full of disasters. So
let's introduce you. You are husband and wife, and you are the restaurateurs behind a chain. Is chain the right word? Or how do you describe your restaurant empire in San Antonio, Texas?
Oh, diminished. And we call it a group and not a chain.
Not a chain. Okay, I misspoke. So you have been married for how many years?
33 years.
33 years. And which came first, the marriage or the first restaurants?
I've been in the restaurant business for 42 years, and so Susie, I caught her in a weak moment and talked her into marrying me, even in spite of the fact that I was in the restaurant business.
Now, Susie, do you have any experience with the restaurant industry, or was this a totally new thing for you?
Oh, I totally backed into it. I sold real estate when we first got married for 15 years, and then one day we decided I should really learn more about the restaurants, and I got into it, and I really enjoyed it, and we've been doing it ever since.
And your son is also involved, right? Also, right? Your son, Trevor?
Yes.
So how?
He's our general manager.
He was forewarned also, but he ended up liking it a lot.
And I have to say, I love it. It's why we do it and why I continue to do it despite my harrowing tales. But how do you guys make it work? I think that if I worked in a restaurant with my husband and our son, we might kill each other. So what are some of the things that you guys do to stay happy and friendly with each other?
Well, first, I'm just thinking back to your previous question. We had a horrendous disaster this summer. We got a call at 9 o'clock in the morning that one of our restaurants was on fire. It turns out some roofers accidentally caught our restaurant on fire, and we have lived through a harrowing experience all through the summer. It took us 3 months to rebuild the restaurant. But like everything, it had a silver lining and put our team closer together. Our son got to work real closely with us in a disastrous situation, and it was a good thing.
That is a real disaster. What time?
Over $1 million in fire damage, and not anything we had planned to do. We had canceled two major trips that we had we're looking forward to going on. But Susie bore on with it just like everybody else and did a great job.
So in your kitchen life together, and I'm happy to hear that everything seems to be resolved, and are you back open in that place again?
Yes.
So is that a relatively quick turnaround for something like that, or is that pretty normal?
Pretty much everyone said that we did 6 months' worth of construction in less than, in about 2 months.
Yeah, that seems amazingly quick.
It was 7 days a week and 10, 15 hours a day.
So tell me, Susie, about a moment when you felt like you were leaning on Cappy to get through that moment.
Every day I'd go down there. In Texas, it gets very hot in the summer, and we would have to make decisions with the construction and the engineers and the architects, and basically we would be standing in our hot restaurant burning up while we made some of these decisions, and I just said, we have got to hit it as hard as we possibly can. You know, please get us out of this. And Cappy did. He and Trevor were marvelous.
That's
You'd
awesome.
Have to know Susie to know, Emily, that she doesn't lean on anybody.
As much as I could.
So, Cappy, tell me about the process of deciding that you were going to write this cookbook. Now, I have in my hands this beautiful copy of Enchiladas Aztec to Tex-Mex, which I got in the mail a few weeks ago. And I'm curious to know what the kind of conversations you guys had around the dinner table about whether or not this was something you wanted to undertake, or is this something you've always wanted to do? Walk me through that process.
Well, I love projects altogether. I've built 29 restaurants over the years and then restored 7 old houses. And that reading your bio, it sounds like you and I suffer the same sort of ADD and frenetic personality. And anyway, building a restaurant is a lot of fun. It's great. But then you got to run it for another X number of years. So it sounded like a lot of fun to write a cookbook, and much less arduous. However, that didn't turn out to be true. It took us about 3 years to write that cookbook, and it's a lot like building a restaurant. So it took a whole team of people and designers and developers and cooks and chefs and everyone's input and a lot of work. But it's been a lot of fun. It's been fun to learn a whole new business. And now we're at the marketing phase. I've never tried to market a cookbook before, but it's fun.
And were you cooking these recipes at home as you were going through the process of choosing what was going to be included?
A lot at home, a lot in our restaurants. And we have a restaurant called La Fonda on Main Avenue, which this year will be 83 years old. And I think it's the oldest restaurant in San Antonio, but it's certainly the oldest Mexican restaurant. And about 20 years ago, Susie and I bought it and totally remodeled it. And we have a tremendous team of people there. And so we cooked well over 200 enchilada recipes and to come up with 63 that we thought were really memorable and different and delicious, unique.
Now, why enchiladas of all of the sort of categories of Mexican food? What brought you there?
Well, I've been traveling to Mexico since I was young. When Susie and I got married, we went there on our honeymoon and went back at least once a year for the next 20 years. And everywhere we traveled in Mexico, there are different kinds of enchiladas. And in San Antonio, most people would think there's only one kind of enchilada. We call it a Tex-Mex enchilada. But when you go to various towns, cities, provinces, regions of Mexico, there's very, very different enchiladas in every area that are unique to that area. And whole concept today about buying local and seasonal and all that stuff, it always kind of makes me grin because They have obviously been doing that for years and centuries in Mexico. It's not a unique concept to most poor countries. And when we did La Fonda on Maine, we wanted to have authentic interior Mexican food, which was, San Antonio has about 5,000 restaurants. 1,000 of them call themselves Mexican restaurants, and they are great. They're very good, but very few, if any, had interior Mexican food. So our idea was to try to introduce that. Bought tons and tons of cookbooks and took all the notes from our travel experiences. And one of the things that was always curious to me is that there are lots of books on salsas and other specialty dishes and Mexican food, but I could never find one on enchiladas. And I thought, what a shame, because they sort of define Mexican food.
Susie, can you tell me one of the most memorable things you ate when you were traveling together in Mexico?
Oh, Mexico. Every meal is an experience. Probably molletes, which are wonderful. It's a bolillo that's toasted cheese and beans and salsa and avocado, and it's a wonderful dish. I love the enchiladas callejeras, which are street food enchiladas that have chorizo and potatoes and peas and carrots. Gosh, everything you eat in Mexico seems to ring a bell. I can go on and on. I don't know if you want me to, though, or not.
Oh, man, I've neglected to eat lunch before the show, and I'm like, oh, man, that sounds, everything you're saying sounds so delicious.
Yeah, look at the pictures in the book. You can eat with your eyes.
Oh, I am flipping through the pictures. They are absolutely beautiful. And I want to talk more. I need to take a quick break. And then when we come back, I'm going to ask you some more questions about how to navigate the kitchen and Mexican cuisine.
Take a sip from you. Jealous just and I bow my head to you. Cause kicking myself would be a waste of bruises, and you won't allow that can do.
In 1996, L. Knife & Son acquired Union Beer Distributors, which was originally located on Union Avenue in Brooklyn, but has since expanded to its present location alongside the English Kills Canal in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Union Beer has grown dramatically in the last decade as the primary distributor of Anheuser-Busch products for Kings County, Brooklyn, through the hiring and development of the best people in the industry. In 2003, Union Beer acquired a powerful catalog of specialty brands, which immediately positioned them as the craft beer supplier to accounts in Manhattan, Brooklyn, Queens, and Staten Island. Union perpetually tweaks their portfolio to maintain the highest level of stylistic breadth with the most coveted brands available. Through the highest possible level of service, outstanding salesmanship of the ultimate lineup of brands, and a paramount focus on education on all levels, Union Beer has solidified its position as the only source for the best selection of beers in the 14 counties of southeastern New York. For more information, visit greatbrewers.com.
Welcome back to Sharp and Hot, everyone. I am your host, Chef Emily Peterson, broadcasting to you live from Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Joining me on the line from San Antonio, Texas, are Cappy and Susie Lawton, author. Cappy is the author of Enchiladas, Aztec to Tex-Mex. And welcome back, guys.
Thank you. Thank you.
So I'm curious, in your home kitchen, if there's one of you who's sort of in charge all the time, or if you share the responsibilities depending on the meal.
In our house, Susie's always in charge, anyway. or we like to say that anyway.
Susie, do you agree with that assessment?
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. We actually share a lot. We both cook a lot. I think basically it's getting our space in front of our cooktop that's probably the biggest battle area. But we work it out. We have a good time.
And when you were first dating, or when you first got married and were moving in together and living together, was there a habit that one that the other person had that you were like, I don't know if I can, this is going to drive me insane?
Good question. Cleaning up. I'm the clean queen.
And so how do you...
Susie, Emily, every time I turn around, I go, have you seen the knife I was using? She said, yeah, I washed it and I put it up.
Oh, we have...
I wasn't through with it.
We have so much in common. My husband is always looking for his water glass.
No, done, gone, in dishwasher.
It's in the dishwasher. That's why we have a dishwasher, for the dirty... I feel this. And I can't say that I'm super clean, but things just, like, left out drive me absolutely crazy.
Me too.
And how do you guys handle the holiday cooking? Do you start planning Thanksgiving in August?
Not anymore. We used to. Susie's also the planning queen. And Susie is a very, very good cook, but she always wanted a recipe, wanted to follow a recipe. And to me, recipes are simply guidelines for some fool. So,
we're going to talk more about your cookbook in a minute and how you made things differently.
So, when we cook together, we've gotten balanced and used to it. But Susie said, well, it doesn't call for that. And I said, well, yeah, but it would be good if it had it. And so we've gone back and forth, but finally in a great balance. And she's trusted my judgment some.
And so now, as someone who's gone through the recipe writing process, for someone like me, who is a born and bred New Yorker, who was now is a transplant to New Jersey, I've never been to Mexico. My experience with Mexican cuisine is relatively limited to what I have access to in my cookbooks and my travels. How has your experience writing this book sort of helped you communicate with someone like me who doesn't necessarily know all of the ingredients or steps that you would take as second nature?
You know, Emily, Susie and I love to travel, and we've traveled a lot through Europe and South America, lots of different places. But my prediction 20 years ago was that probably Italian is the primary ethnic cuisine in America today, particularly among higher-end cooks and chefs. But my prediction was that Mexican was going to come on strong, if not overtake it, because in a lot of ways, it's a much more complex and interesting cuisine. We've traveled all through Italy bunches of times, and I love Italian food. I think it's delicious. But can you imagine Italian food without tomatoes? And tomatoes came from Mexico, so as did many, many, many things. And if you get a chance, I highly recommend you go into Mexico and tasting the food and the flavors of Mexico.
It is on...
Well, you know, Emily, you can also start, since Mexican food isn't really something that you're totally familiar with, as we are down here, you can awaken your palate by picking out some of your favorite ingredients and finding a recipe that fits... it doesn't sound too outrageous, and start from there, and then slowly progress and get more exciting with the different chilies, both the fresh and the dried chilies, and the way you process them or toast them or whatever. And I think the recipes help you along those steps. Certainly, making the tortillas yourself is another step. You don't have to start out right away doing it, because I think you can pretty much buy them anywhere, but you take it to a different level when you go through the recipes.
I have to say, last semester, I teach at NYU, and I was introduced to a fresh tortilla making factory in Queens that supplies all of the New York City's good, really good Mexican restaurants with fresh masa. And so my palate, talk about awakening my palate. It was like, holy smokes, this is incredible. It was like day and night. So I took that step. So tell me, if you were to set me free in your cookbook here, I'm flipping through the pages. It's beautiful. It's really well laid out. What's your favorite that I should start with? Let's say I have a whole day and I'm going to do a whole cooking project with my husband in the kitchen.
Do you like seafood? Do you like beef? Do you like pork? Do you like chicken? Do you like vegetarian?
First is, all, if you don't mind, all enchiladas begin with tortillas and corn. And it really is fun to make your own tortillas, and it's very easy. In fact, we have a video on our, we have a website called enchiladasbook.com. And on that website, we have a really fun video that our co-author, Chris Waters Dunn, is the voiceover on it, and it really explains very simply how to make tortillas. And tortillas are great fun to make because you can flavor them with all kinds of things and put all kinds of fun things in them. So I might recommend that you look in our book about how to make tortillas and that you start there.
All right, and I'm gonna, as soon as we're off the air, I'm going to tweet that link out too so that everyone who's listening can go and look at it as well.
Thank you.
For sure.
And Chris did a masterful job of writing a lot of the descriptions in the book, and he's a great writer.
Right, so Chris Waters Dunn is your co-author on this book, who's also a career changer, right, who worked in the country music industry and then decided to run away to culinary school.
I think Chris has over 1,000 copyrighted country western songs and over 10 number one hits. So he had a great career in that industry first.
And are you guys friends, or were you put together for the purposes of this project?
He moved to San Antonio and later in life decided to change his careers. And someone said, you guys would really like each other a lot. And so we met about 5 years ago. We've been working on this book for 3 years. And so we were pretty good friends when we started. We're very good friends now.
How does it feel to be done with the book? I mean, I realize you're in the marketing phase, but what does it feel like to hold it in your hands?
You know, it's very akin to dreaming up a restaurant. I usually build restaurants in my head, and I think exactly, I can walk through it, and I can see the restaurant. And with a cookbook, you pretty much have to do the same thing. Had it well laid out and thought up how we wanted it to be and how we wanted it to be different. And it's just thrilling and exciting when you have those kind of ideas, and then you can actually ultimately touch them, walk in them, sit in them, read them, whatever it is, whatever your idea is. And you sound like a very creative person. I think you probably would know exactly what I'm talking about.
I do, and I want you to know that in addition to all of those feelings, there will be people like myself in my small kitchen in New Jersey who are going to make your recipes and cook through your book, and that's like another part that you can't touch and feel, but know that those people are going to be out there reading your words and using your life experience to create beautiful meals together.
Well, thanks. Well, you know, and we come to New York often, and we do house calls, too. So.
Oh, that's wonderful. And you mentioned old houses. I live in a house that was built, we think, sometime between 1690 and 1720.
Oh, boy.
So you're welcome to come over and poke around anytime you want. We have lots of exposed beams to look at.
I love restoring old things. So
I think we have a lot in common.
Well, it sounds like it. No, we come to New York at least once a year, and sometimes two and three times a year, and really love the city. My father was born in New York, so.
Next time you're here, please email me. I would love to have we'll have a meal together.
Thank you. That sounds like fun.
All right, Cappy and Susie Lawton, thank you so much. The book is called Enchiladas Aztec to Tex-Mex. The website is enchiladasbook.com. I'm going to tweet that out right after the show. Speaking of social media, I have a brand new bookshelf filled with books that I need to give away to you guys, the listeners. So use the hashtag #SharpAndHot on photographs of your food that you're taking already, and I will email you and ask you for an address to where I should mail your books and get them off my hands. I can't use them all, and now I have a new favorite. My enchiladas book is going to be front and center for a while. And if you are in New York City, tomorrow night I am hosting and chefing Fried and Fizzy at Astor Center. I believe there's still a few tickets left. You can go to AstorCenterNYC.com for tickets to that. And then I'm going to lay low for a while. I'm going to focus on teaching and the radio show, but as soon as there's more events, I will get those out to you guys. If you like what you hear, please go to iTunes and leave us a positive review. Click up some 5 stars. Tell your friends. You can donate on heritageradionetwork.org by clicking the little beating heart that's up in the corner. That is the best way to support Heritage Radio Network. We could not do what we do without the support of listeners and members like you. Thank you to engineer Liz Smith, who is sitting in for Jack Inslee today. She is absolutely wonderful. The break music was provided by Odetta Hartman. Thank you to the sponsor Union Beer Distributors. And next up is a short clip from Greenhorns Radio. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And until next week, everyone, keep playing with fire and knives.
Geese eat grass. They're very good at eating grass. And they're quite strong poultry. They don't really have the same problems that chickens or other kind of weaker species have. They can be outside in a hurricane and be totally fine. You know, you might lose a few and they might get blown down the river, but they're not going to get chilled and they're not going to have any trouble with kind of small varmints.
Young farmers Wesley Bascom and David Hart recently started grazing geese in Vermont. They talk about all these interesting birds in episode 163 of Greenhorns Radio.
Well, I personally find them to be endlessly fascinating. They are not the, you know, vile, mean creatures of the myth. They are really curious, inquisitive, very bright birds that just, they're really fascinating. They do all sorts of things, and I think it takes a close inspection of them to really appreciate this. They are noisy, that's true, but they talk to each other. It's not just endless noise. It's an actual conversation that's occurring, and I find that somewhat amusing, honestly.
Hear more voices of young farmers like Wesley and David on Greenhorns Radio, Tuesdays at 4 p.m., and listen to past episodes on Heritage Radio Network and iTunes.